Hey guys, you're listening to the most captivating podcast in iTunes. That's right, the Elite Man Podcast, where we turn average men into elite men every day. We interview the very best experts from the lifestyle, health, fitness, social, and even entrepreneurial worlds. And with their help, we give you some of the best advice on the planet. Subscribe now if you haven't already and enjoy the show. And oh yeah, if you really enjoy it, leave us a review. On today's episode, episode number 164, entitled How to Optimize Your Health and Fitness by Testing Your Genes, I chat with Dr. Dan Reardon. Dr. Dan Reardon is a medical doctor, personal trainer, and the co-founder and CEO of Fitness Genes, one of the world's top fitness DNA testing companies. In today's episode, Dr. Reardon talks about how we can optimize our health and fitness by looking at our genes and making changes to our lifestyle based on what our genes tell us. He covers the incredible science behind gene testing, epigenetics, what some of the most important genes to test for are, and what my personal DNA tests actually reveal about me. If you're wondering how your genes can help you optimize your health and fitness goals, how you can personalize your lifestyle to optimize your health, and what my personal genes actually tell me about my health and fitness aspirations, check this episode out now. You are going to love it. Also, Dr. Dan was nice enough to provide a 30% off coupon if you guys are interested in getting a DNA test yourself. You can use the coupon code ELITE30 at checkout.
Hey, if you haven't signed up for the Elite Man newsletter yet, go to elitemanmagazine.com/newsletter. This is an incredible newsletter which helps you become the best man you can be. Every single week, we give you the best tips, strategies, and techniques for helping you master your personal, social, and business life and give you exclusive content not seen nor heard on the podcast or anywhere else. That's elitemanmagazine.com/newsletter. Sign up right now. And now, a word from our fantastic Elite Man podcast sponsors.
The Elite Man podcast is sponsored by HealthIQ, an insurance company that helps health-conscious people like runners, cyclists, weightlifters, and vegetarians get lower rates on their life insurance. Go to healthiq.com/elite to support the show and see if you qualify. HealthIQ uses science and data to secure lower rates on life insurance for health-minded individuals. You, being an Elite Man podcast listener, are almost certainly among those health-conscious people. That's why you should really listen up. HealthIQ can save customers up to 33% because physically active people have a 56% lower risk of heart disease, 20% lower risk of cancer, and a 58% lower risk of diabetes compared to people who are inactive. So HealthIQ rewards you for being active and taking care of yourself. How cool is that? Look, you never know what's going to happen, especially if you're married, have children, or you've had personal scares or family members dealing with health issues. This is something you definitely cannot take lightly. It's so important to make sure your loved ones are kept safe no matter what, and HealthIQ helps you do that. It's the fastest growing life insurance company in the world with over $5 billion in coverage, and they're rated 9.6 out of 10 by Trustpilot. Do yourself and your family a huge favor and check out HealthIQ. To see if you qualify for an incredible savings of up to 33%, get your free quote today at healthiq.com/elite, or mention the promo code ELITE when you talk to a HealthIQ agent. Again, that's healthiq.com/elite. All right, guys, we're live. It's Justin Stenstrom from elitemanmagazine.com, and my guest today is Dr. Dan Reardon from fitnessgenes.com. Dr. Dan, thanks so much for coming on the show, man.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm really excited to bring you on. I actually took the DNA test myself probably a couple months back now, so I got the results, and I'm really excited to go over them with you. Basically, what you do is, well, Fitness Genes, you guys take a number of, you look over a number of genes and see how it relates to each person's body type and, you know, what kind of things they might be better at doing, like exercise-wise, sleep-wise, diet-wise, all those things, and sort of give them a good idea of the best things to choose, like to go after, and maybe the best diets and the best exercises types to use and that kind of thing. So it's really unique what you're doing. Can you just, before we go over some of the results and talk about some of the science and stuff behind it, can you for a minute or two just fill in the holes there and kind of how you fill in the audience with how you got to this point and came up with this company here, Fitness Genes?
Yes, of course. Yeah. So I'm a medical doctor by background. Whilst I was at medical school, I trained as a personal trainer, opened a gym, got really into using exercise and nutrition as a means to achieving, obviously, body composition related goals, really got into the science of it and even the psychology of it and understanding people's behaviors that enabled them to achieve their goals when it comes to weight loss or building muscle. I was particularly interested in the science of bodybuilding. You know, as a doctor, you tend to find doctors tend to be very interested in extremes, whether it's extremes in things like, you know, cancer studies or heart disease or hormonal diseases. And for me, it was my real interest was all about fat loss, and specifically in bodybuilders, because they were the extreme within that context. And when I graduated, I sold the personal training business and the gym, and I worked for 10 years as a clinical doctor. But in that time, I wrote two books for Weta Publishing, one on high intensity interval training, one on sports nutrition and supplements. And I was the science editor of Muscle and Fitness magazine for the UK, Europe and Australia. And it was in 2011 that me and one of my best friends, Dr. Stuart Grice, who's a PhD geneticist, were talking about gene variations that were prevalent in certain types of athletes. And it was at that point that I said to Stuart, well, it's quite interesting because I'm pretty sure if I knew this information about somebody, I would be able to tailor workouts and nutrition plans much more. And that really launched us into a period of research and development where ultimately in 2013, in fact, it was June 27th of 2013, we launched Fitness Genes as a company where we were really focused on trying to empower individuals with a knowledge of their own biology to enable them to achieve their goals. But with us, it was about understanding the genetics. So it was off the back of a DNA test.
And ever since then, since 2013, you guys just kind of hit the ground running, right?
That's right. Yes. So we launched in 2013. We immediately had a market to sell to. So we were selling products from the outset. I would say over the 5 years that we've been trading, if you like, we've learned, you know, an awful lot about the real problems that we're trying to solve with our science and technology. You know, we've grown to now a company of almost 40 people. We've been through, you know, seed funding. We raised our Series A funding last year. So, you know, we've really learned about everything from how to build a science company, how to implement technology platforms, how to grow an organization, how to raise money, how to, you know, position the business in both the market and also in the consumer, the finance market and the consumer market, how to build communities and how to really understand the problems that we're trying to solve.
How accurate are these tests and how specific can they get in telling and giving you an idea of the different like exercises or diets or sleep or whatever else that you're looking into? How specific can they give you in terms of detail of what is best for somebody?
Well, I mean, the thing when it comes to exercise and nutrition and sports supplements, this kind of market and recommendations within this sort of topic, you can get information anywhere. And of course, all the information is generic. If it's in a magazine, on a website, you know, from your favorite influencer, it's generic information. So the second you start to provide some sort of account, some sort of evidence as to why small things might be more important for one person than another, then obviously the concept of personalization kicks in. And the accuracy of the information is generally, you generally think about it as being on almost like a normal distribution, where the information is going to be accurate for the majority of people, but there are always going to be outliers that are always going to be different. And obviously, you know, the outliers tend to get less and less the further they are on the outlier curve, if you like. But you know, on the whole, the information is accurate for most people. In terms of the accuracy of the DNA testing, I mean, we use some of the best technologies on the market. So, you know, the accuracy of the actual DNA test is, I mean, you're talking about, you know, 0.001% percentage of errors. So, you know, I would say DNA test is incredibly accurate. And in terms of the information that we deliver, you know, on a classic normal distribution, it will be accurate for most people.
In terms of people having certain genes, how much does it, what are the chances of those genes actually getting expressed? And what is your ability to, you know, individually, people listening, what are their individual abilities to manipulate that, to be able to control whether those genes are expressed or not?
Well, I mean, you can't really influence whether your genes are expressed or not. I mean, there are, you know, you can start going into epigenomics and all that sort of stuff, you know, which is specifically focused on gene expression and changes in gene expression. But, you know, our our expertise is really in understanding the effects of genes that are expressed. So, you know, when a gene produces a protein, what is it that that protein does with regards to, with regards to physiologies that would interest us in terms of exercise and nutrition. So we're not actually trying to do anything to change the output of a gene. All we're trying to do is understand what the gene actually does and therefore try and counter things that somebody or characteristics somebody does or doesn't have in the way that we prescribe exercise or nutrition-related methods.
For the genes that you do test for, are there other genes that maybe counteract that gene or come into play as well?
Yes, I mean, so within our members area, we do give people information about individual gene results, but when we actually deliver recommendations, the recommendations aren't built from individual genes; they're built from the ways that multiple genes interact with each other, and so therefore we do account for the different kind of levels of importance genes might have within particular traits. So for example, you know, we look at a gene that's all to do with lactic acid clearance, the MCT1 gene. But when it comes to giving the recommendation about, let's say, things like rest or tempo, we're not just taking into account the MCT1 gene, we're taking into account multiple genes that would contribute to that trait, as well as environmental information as well. So, you know, on a recommendation level, we actually account for the genes, for multiple genes. But in terms of when we're delivering the DNA results, you know, people do just like to, yeah, people enjoy reading about what their gene result might be for a particular gene and what that might mean for them.
Mm-hmm. Are there any encounters that you've faced doing this so far in terms of figuring out which genes work? And, you know, I mean, the whole human genome project is still pretty much in its infancy. They thought, you know, when they first unraveled it, that it'd be pretty easy to get all the genes and, you know, they'd wrap it up in a couple of years, but they're just still working on it, you know, tediously, because there's just so much in it. It's so much more complex than they had imagined. And even though I think the total number of genes is like 25,000 or something, and they thought it was going to be 100,000, they're learning now that the 25,000 genes are infinitely more complex, and there's so much to it than even if it was a lot more than they initially thought. Are there some types of issues or encounters that you've had with that you're working over or trying to, you know, get over that now?
The research that we do is really based on SNPs. So, you know, we're focused on research, whether it's pre-existing research or whether it's our own research. We're focused on SNPs and, you know, looking at characteristics or differences between individuals where they're expressing certain proteins as a result of certain changes in their DNA. And so for us, you know, because that's what we're focused on, you know, we don't really worry too much about other areas of DNA that people might be discovering or other types of testing people might be doing, because yes, they're going to be researching against that, but we're researching against the things that we can do, which is looking at SNPs or, you know, single nucleotide polymorphism. So yeah, obviously we were always paying attention to the new things that are coming onto the market and the new types of testing people are doing and the new regions of DNA that people might be looking at. But for us, you know, we're really focused on looking at SNPs, and we're really focused on looking at genes that produce proteins where there's, you know, measurable levels of the proteins in the blood, and they are exerting significant physiological effects.
So the SNPs thing, how many different types of genes actually do you test? I think I remember taking the test. I forget how many it was up there. How many total genes do you look at?
Yes, so at the moment we're looking at, well, it's okay. So the in terms of where we are today, we're actually now looking at 750,000 SNPs.
Wow.
When you took the test, you'd have been tested on about 41 SNPs. But even though we're now testing 750,000 SNPs, you'll only see about 48 SNPs reported within the member site. But with some of the background models and calculations and recommendations that we build out, we might be using multiple SNPs. And over the next sort of 2 years, 2 or 3 years, we'll be increasing the amount of genetic information that we deliver into our members area. And obviously the complexity of the calculations and algorithms that we use to deliver trait recommendations and recommendations on exactly what people are doing will be, you know, using, you know, many, many, many tens of thousands of SNP results. And of course, as the company's grown and as our the number of scientists we have has grown, and as the number of academic collaborations we have has grown, our ability to research against the 750,000 SNPs increases. And I'm sure you can appreciate, you know, it's an incredible amount of data, you know, per person. When you start accounting for all the biometric information as well, it's a massive data that we're now sort of, you know, trying to work our way through to, you know, really increase the precision of the engines that we've built.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's definitely great work you're doing. I think that, you know, the potential for this to really revolutionize the way people live their life in terms of exercise, dieting, sleep, all that stuff that goes into it, I think is profound, and I think can really help a lot of people. The 48 SNPs, though, that you use, I mean, that's such a, it seems like such a small drop in the bucket of the 750,000. Are these like more of the important ones, the kind of the powerful SNPs, the more active SNPs, I guess you could say, or is it just that you haven't gotten around to getting the other ones out yet?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of SNPs that are really sort of related, where, you know, related to, say, you know, elements of fitness or elements of nutrition, there's, you know, let's say at the moment there's probably about, you know, let's say there's probably about 200 or so that are really, really good. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these we're using in the new model, but we just haven't created a lot of the written text yet for what the genes actually are. And you know, we're on a schedule now over the next sort of few months to gradually, you know, increase the number that we're representing within the members area. But that's not to say that they're not getting used within the calculations and algorithms that deliver the recommendations. Mm-hmm. But the reality is, you know, there's 750,000 SNPs, but that doesn't necessarily mean that this is 750,000 that are particularly useful. And in fact, we recently partnered with Illumina via a consortium in Holland, using a brand new microarray system called the GSA. So this in terms of technology, supersedes something that was originally on the market called the Omni 7, which was Illumina's previous most successful microarray product. And the thing is with this particular array is there's a lot of stuff on there that might relate to more medical things. For us, it's all about extracting what's most important when it comes to the things that we specialize in and focus on, which is fitness and nutrition. So, you know, it's 750,000 things that control everything to do with a human. And for us, it's about picking out the things that are most important for what we do.
Okay, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Have you noticed any common themes? I think this is kind of an interesting question. Have you noticed any common themes between certain types of people? Like, are certain types of people, certain groups of people, maybe their ethnicity, that, you know, their nationality, where they're from, do they tend to have different types of like exercise genes and different things that make them, say, good for long distance running or maybe better sprinters, that type of thing?
I mean, you do definitely start to see trends. There's no doubt in that. Now, from my perspective, you have to understand that when I see trends, it's generally biased because, you know, let's say, for example, I'm doing interviews with athletes or interviews with, you know, sports publications or, you know, the sports media and fitness media. Well, then, you know, I'm in a self-selected audience that are generally fit and healthy. And, you know, and the chances are they've come from sports backgrounds or fitness backgrounds. And so, you know, there are certain, say gene variations, should we say, that, you know, you do find that they're common, but it's not necessarily reflective of the real world. It's just that this is a population where you might expect them to be, you know, perhaps have a slightly different gene profile that more relates to, let's say, things that might benefit athletes and fitness related people. From our perspective as a company, discovery is important, and we actually work with a number of universities where we are sort of, you know, testing out our theories of things that we've either found or recognized or believed could be true, you know, hypotheses about, you know, certain populations or certain people where we might be seeing, you know, greater frequencies of certain gene variation. So, you know, we're always looking out for trends, but, you know, we do consider ourselves to be a science first company, and therefore we're actually, you know, really quite committed. We've had grants from the UK government for the work that we do, with the innovative work that we do in science and technology. So we actually really are trying to lead a company that has a heavy research and development arm so that we can actually try and discover new things.
Yeah, I've always thought that was, you know, really fascinating, just seeing the different demographics of the world and different types of people. Like, for instance, Boston Marathon, you know, every year for the last 20, 30 years has been a Kenyan or someone right near countryman right near Kenya winning the race every year. And these guys are just, you know, there's something, I think, in their genes that makes them great to be long distance runners and just, you know, dominate in that field. And I think that, you know, as the science comes out on this, it's very interesting to see the different parts of the world where people have different abilities and preferences to excel in a certain area just because of their genes.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, and what's interesting here as well is that it's, you know, it adds weight to the importance of environment. I mean, you know, for some of these incredible African runners, you know, whether they're coming from, you know, Kenya, Ethiopia, you know, wherever they're coming from, you know, you sort of have to understand that, you know, this is a population of people where, you know, they get up early in the morning and, you know, they'll run 10-15 miles to get to school or to get to a location where they can pick up clean water, or, you know, there's some real historic environmental reasons why, you know, this particular population are so incredibly fit. And of course, that, you know, there's genetic relationships. There's some very, very interesting genetic relationships around, you know, countries that have a lot of malaria, how, you know, the genes for sickle cell disease, being heterozygous for the sickle cell trait is an advantage because it reduces the oxygen carrying capacity of your blood. So you don't die of malaria, but you also get slight changes in the type of, or the particular type of muscle that you would activate more. So there's lots of very, very interesting things. And, you know, I find the prevalence of certain ethnic groups or races within certain sports to be, you know, an incredibly interesting area to study, and, you know, and for us to really understand as well, to really understand how we can all, you know, coach people to excel in sports by understanding why certain populations are just so good at certain things. And, you know, as a science company, it's something that we pay a lot of attention to.
Yeah, like I said before, I think it's just fascinating. The other thing too is, I know you don't necessarily do this, but it, like, in terms of gene expression, what are your thoughts on epigenetics and the ability to change the way something, you know, the way your genes are expressed? For instance, I'm thinking of the Native Americans here in this country, in America, like, for, you know, whatever, hundreds or maybe even thousands of years that they were here before, they were fairly healthy. They had diets that were pretty normal. And then, you know, the last 100, 200 years, when a lot of them got moved over to the reservations and they were eating like this, you know, high carb diet, a lot of them get a lot of these diseases, you know, the chronic diseases, the metabolic diseases, the diabetes, that kind of thing, just because of their diet changes. Like, how much effect does, or can you have on your genes in real time? Like, not just over the course of hundreds of thousands of years and developing that thing, the genes to have these certain traits, but how much, like, in real life can you actually affect that ability?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, so first of all, the you know, your environment will exert an effect on, you know, certain aspects of your biology. I mean, but it's not necessarily that it's exerting an epigenetic effect. I mean, the concept of epigenetics is this idea of, you know, it's a heritable change in the output of a gene, but without the actual, without there being any, specifically any mutations in the gene. But I think that, you know, I mean, a good example, many years ago when people from Africa were moving to the UK, you know, one of the things that we were finding in the UK was that all of a sudden there was a real sense of urgency for people from Africa having dental treatment. And, you know, they were coming over to the UK and their teeth were rotting really quickly. And, you know, initially people, you know, didn't really understand why. But the reason was, as soon as they got to the UK and they started eating lots of processed foods, you know, they were consuming foods that were really high in sugar and they just weren't used to it. And it, you know, one of the effects that it was having was this rapid decay in their teeth and, you know, obviously the requirement for a lot of dental treatment. So, you know, a change in environment, you know, will exert immediate effects on people. So, you know, for example, when, you know, when sort of First Nation people, you know, were moving, were being moved around, you know, to different reservations or to different parts of, you know, Canada or North America, you know, and they were exposed to different types of diets, well, it would have, but potentially have an immediate effect on them. You know, so if all of a sudden they're going from eating seasonal foods, fruits, vegetables, certain types of meats, to being in an environment where they've got access to processed foods, high energy foods, high sugar foods, well, then it has an immediate effect because their body has to change and adapt to be able to manage high calorie loads, high glycemic foods, therefore there's a requirement for more and more insulin, so more and more pancreatic output, which ultimately could lead to issues with the beta islet cells in the pancreas and eventually diabetes or resistance to insulin and eventually diabetes. So so this isn't necessarily an epigenetic effect. It's actually just an immediate effect as a result of a change in the environment. Now, where these changes, you know, where so the children are inheriting these changes. So, you know, for example, you know, you change your environment and all of a sudden you become incredibly obese and you have children and they're obese. Well, then, yes, that's where there's been an epigenetic effect. But, you know, to assess epigenetics, you have to look down generations to see how the sort of the phenotype, you know, changes as you sort of go down the family line, if you like.
That's an interesting point. So is that something that you've seen, the say like a parent getting obese and then they can actually pass that on to their children?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that's an example of one of the ways they started to identify this concept of epigenetics, was where they were seeing the poor lifestyles of grandparents or parents being reflected in the health of children. So yeah, I mean, it's you know, epigenetics is it's a topic at the moment that everyone's kind of talking about. And, you know, it's something that we need to understand and we need to, you know, be able to, I guess the reality is how we rationalize epigenetics is that if we can start to, you know, change the health of adults now and actually get them focused on exercising and get them focused on eating the right sorts of foods, then as long as they haven't, you know, gone past the point of no return, then theoretically, you know, we hopefully wouldn't have to worry too much about, you know, passing on epigenetic consequences, as long as you can get people on the right path at as early age as possible.
But you're saying that if they don't, if they are obese and they have a, you know, crappy lifestyle and they eat like shit and, you know, they don't take care of them, they don't exercise, all this other stuff, they actually can change their genes and pass them on to their offspring and their children now have a more likelihood of being obese?
It's absolutely there are potential heritable changes that they can pass on. Wow. as a result of their poor lifestyles. Yeah.
Wow. And yeah, I've heard that as well, in sort of in terms of pregnancy. Like before, you know, you used to think like mothers and pregnant mothers could eat whatever they want, they could eat like crap, they could, you know, do whatever they want. But now I think the science is kind of coming out really showing that everything you do during pregnancy, like those things can have an effect on the genes that you pass on to your children when they're born, right?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, and we've known for many, many years, you know, the effects of smoking, the effects of maternal obesity, the effects of alcohol, you know, all of these things exert consequences to the fetus. And, you know, we've known this for a long time. So, you know, absolutely, you know, pregnant mothers, you know, the health of pregnant mothers and even pre-pregnancy, you know, I mean, we all know the importance of folate, you know, pre-pregnancy to reduce the risk of the fetus developing neural tube defects. So there's, it is incredibly important and it shouldn't be underestimated.
Before we dive into the results that I took, which I'm going to share with everybody on the show here in a minute, I wanted to ask you something because I know you covered this, or it was brought to my attention, the truth behind intermittent fasting and as opposed to, say, like a normal diet. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think intermittent fasting is an interesting method of diet, of dieting. And you know, I don't think there's necessarily some secret magic to it. I mean, we all fast. You know, when you go to bed at night and you go to sleep, you don't eat for a period of time. And when you wake up in the morning, you have breakfast. Well, breakfast is break fast. It's all about breaking the fast from the night. Mm-hmm. And really intermittent fasting is just an extended period of time where you're not eating. So it means that you're essentially focusing your calories within a shorter window, which you know, for some people tends to be later in the day, and therefore, you know, as a method of eating, it becomes popular because it has a name, intermittent fasting. And so, you know, people, you know, the media grabs onto this, and you know, people start to talk about, you know, the miracles and, you know, why it's the, you know, one of the best diets out there. And the reality is that for people who have efficient metabolisms, or for people that store energy effectively and they're trying to lose weight, well, intermittent fasting could be an incredibly useful tool in order to do that, because it means that you have the opportunity for fast for longer periods of time. So hopefully you can break into your, you know, fat related energy reserves, because we know that you're able to, you know, we know you have a good store of energy there. Theoretically, you have lots of available energy. And by bringing your calories, or focusing your calories within a narrower window, potentially you end up consuming less calories, and hopefully you end up consuming better quality calories that are more focused on your goal. Because if you're willing to commit to intermittent fasting, you're probably going to be willing to commit to the consumption of more nutrient dense foods, and foods that are better for you and more goal driven. And therefore, I think, you know, intermittent fasting has, you know, some potentially really effective uses. And there's lots of other, you know, things that people believe about the benefits of intermittent fasting. So, I don't believe it's some miracle way of dieting. I don't believe that it's something that heralds masses of mystery. I think the fact is there are a percentage of people out there where intermittent fasting would be an incredible way for them to go about their daily living, and to actually formalize the method of dieting that they use. But it does have to be used effectively, and you do have to understand that it's not about starving yourself for 12 hours or 16 hours and then for 8 hours eating whatever you want. It's a controlled process. It's a controlled regime that has the potential to yield fantastic results if the right people use it as their dieting method.
I think you're absolutely dead on with that. In terms of the more common diets, like say the zone diet and the bodybuilding world, especially like eating every 3 hours, high protein, lower carbs and lower fat, well, moderate carbs and lower fat. What are your thoughts on that? Is that generally a healthy diet for most people, or for people in the bodybuilding world, or is that too much to be constantly eating like that? I know it's great for packing on muscle, packing on size, but is that generally a healthy approach?
I think it depends on the individual. You know, it depends. So it depends on the goal, and it depends on the individual. If you're somebody who is trying to build muscle, then there are a lot of nutritional factors that you need to take into account. So first of all, to build muscle, generally speaking, you need to be in a calorie excess. So you need to be consuming more calories than maintenance. If you're working out hard in the gym, you're going to have a higher protein requirement. And it's not an obscene protein requirement, but you're going to have a higher protein requirement. If you're working hard in the gym, you're probably going to have a greater energy requirement. So, you know, getting good quality carbohydrates in. If you're working hard in the gym, you're probably going to have more of a requirement for, you know, to drive the health of your hormones. So certain types of fats will become important. It's more likely that you're going to be depleting your essential minerals, vitamins, a lot faster. So making sure that you're taking the right sorts of foods with the right sorts of micronutrients will become important. You're probably going to need to consume much more than the recommended daily allowance, because you're going through a supraphysiological process. So there's so many things that you have to take into account. And You know, the idea of eating smaller meals and often from the point of view of building muscle, you know, the reality is, yes, if you could eat your entire day's calories in one go, then, you know, that's fine. Go for it. But the fact is there's not many people that could eat a balanced meal of 2,000-4,000 calories in one go. Because if it's a meal that's, you know, lean protein, high fiber, with the right types of fats, potentially from a volume perspective, it would be too high and you wouldn't be able to eat it. So breaking your meals up through the day, just from a digestive perspective, is just much easier and much healthier. So, I mean, there's many, many reasons, social, digestive, genetic, goal related, individual, preference. There's a million reasons, which go into how you define what your dieting method of choice should be. But and that's why there are, you know, I mean, there's literally millions and millions of potential ways that you could diet and eat. And it's why the consumer faces so many problems.
Yeah. And I, you know, I say this all the time too, like there's always more than one way to do something right. And, you know, I hear all these things like these programs, these fitness experts out there that say just one, you know, they have their little program and they just talk about how great that is and say everything else sucks. But I tend to think that most diets can work for most people. And just like you said, and looking into the science of things, some people are more inclined to do better or do more well in some areas and with different protocols. I just got reminded of something. The old, if you want to call it a myth or the belief in the bodybuilding world is in the consumption, in terms of consumption of protein, is that you can only really consume about 30 grams of protein at a time. And, you know, most of these protein shakes out there have between like 20 or 30 grams per scoop or whatever. And then you hear guys like Tim Ferriss, who came out, you know, a couple of years later and saying that you can actually consume protein, you can consume an you know, exorbitant amount of protein in one sitting, and that your body actually does use it. It just takes longer to digest it and actually be used. And you mentioned, I just got reminded of that when you said you can consume all your calories potentially in one meal, but it's more effective to do it, you know, spread out. So what are your thoughts on that? Is the 30 gram belief or myth, is that true or false?
Well, false. It's a myth. I mean, there's no set number, because of course it's very dependent on the size of the individual. You know, is the individual fasted? Are they fed? When did they last eat? What's the state of their digestive health? What was the source of the protein? There's a million different variables that go into that. But the reality is what dictates if you're a bodybuilder, so if you're someone who's trying to build muscle, what dictates the amount of protein you consume is not necessarily grams of protein, but it's actually the amount of leucine. So leucine is a particular amino acid. It's one of the branched chain amino acids, and it's the amino acid that drives a process called mTOR, which ultimately leads to the repair of muscle and obviously the growth of muscle. It does a number of other things as well. And if you're consuming crappy protein, then you generally have a much higher requirement from crappy protein sources to get in enough leucine to be able to have the desired effects. Whereas if you're consuming, you know, good quality protein, then, you know, you generally can get away with consuming less of it because, you know, there's enough leucine in there. So, you know, a good example of this might be, I mean, you know, for example, how often have you heard, you know, bodybuilders eating, you know, 10, 12, you know, egg whites for breakfast? Well, you know, 10 or 12 egg whites sounds like a lot, but if it's egg whites, you know, if these are small eggs, there might only be sort of 3 or 4 grams of protein per egg. So at breakfast, they're only getting 30, 35 grams of protein from egg whites. But the thing is, the reason why they can get away with that is because egg whites are so high in leucine. So they know immediately they're immediately getting that hit of protein to drive muscle protein synthesis. You know, whereas, you know, throughout the rest of the day, they might be consuming their much larger amounts of protein because obviously they want to get the desired amounts of the important amino acids that are going to contribute to the repair of muscle tissue post-training. But what I would say that is generally accepted now is that bodybuilders are consuming less protein on the whole. So, you know, bodybuilders are realizing more and more that they can get away with, if they're consuming better quality protein, they can consume less of it. And it's really because there's a better amino acid profile that's actually enabling them to achieve what they want to achieve. So the 30 gram number is a myth, because obviously it's going to be on an individual basis, but also activity dependent and also goal driven.
What is the like milligram content of the leucine, and are there a couple other important amino acids that come into play as well?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the essential amino acids are the ones that are important. There's 8 or 9 essential amino acids that we have to get in our diet. So you know, we want as much of the essential amino acids as we can possibly get, and therefore that's going to come from whole protein sources. Now, the best way to get your essential amino acids is, the easiest way to get your essential amino acids is from animal sources, but you can also, you know, I am an advocate for plant-based eating as well. So you know, by varying your plant-based protein source, that you can easily get your all of your essential amino acids from plant-based sources as well.
Are there some bad types of protein foods that you see people eating? And what are the bad protein foods out there, and what are some of the good ones besides the eggs?
Well, so to come back to what I said about the eggs, it's goal driven. So if you're a lean person and your goal is to build muscle, and you're working out really, really hard in the gym, it makes sense to ensure that you're consuming you know, good quality protein, especially protein that's high in leucine to drive the repair process of everything you can to grow muscle. But if you're someone who's very overweight, well, actually, first of all, you don't want to be consuming too many calories anyway. But secondly, the risk of consuming too much protein and consuming too much leucine is that it will also drive the growth of fat cells as well. So, the best sources of protein, you know, I'm a big fan of any plant-based source of protein, just because it makes people reduce their overall meat consumption. I like some of the sources of grass-fed beef and ethically sourced or ethically farmed beef, especially on the West Coast. There's some fantastic farms that do some really, really good quality beef. I think that fish is lots of different types of fish are incredible sources of protein. But, you know, the problem is we're overfishing the waters, and, you know, we're putting ourselves at risk in 20 years time or 40 years time of actually there being no wild caught fish available anymore. So, you know, I try and apply some ethics when I actually talk about the best source of protein. I think, there are some great supplemental sources of protein, some great, whey protein powders, some great vegan and plant-based sources of protein. The one thing that I try to get people not to consume is too much chicken, because I think that chicken on the whole if I just sit back as well, when I'm talking about eggs, I like eggs, but I always make sure where my eggs have been sourced from. And on the whole, I get my eggs from places where you can actually go in there and see the chickens and see that they're, they're running around in, all these incredible areas. So I think we do have a moral duty to make sure that our sources of protein are ethical and are, they're not coming from these horrible, disgusting factories. But chicken, you look at the chicken farming world, and it's so bad. And, there's all sorts of horrible things that they're finding, with chicken now. I mean, one of the things that, I was absolutely right. Actually, it didn't surprise me was when, someone told me that one of the problems with chicken is that when chickens are kept in really bad conditions, some of the muscle tissue actually starts to go through necrosis. So even with, you might be eating a chicken breast, but there could be quite a lot of necrotic tissues in the chicken breast, which actually draws in fat in the necrosis process. So you might be eating chicken breasts that are actually a lot higher in fat than you think. So there's just the, yeah, I mean, I think, as you know, always look for the most ethically sourced protein if it's coming from animal sources. But I think it's important for everybody to try and get as much plant-based protein into their diet as possible as well.
No, absolutely, man. Just a few more minutes here. We got to kind of wrap things up, but I want to quickly go over the results that my tests had. Is there anything going down the board or anything that kind of stuck out to you in terms of exercise or diet? And I guess the intermittent fasting thing, you know, we talked about earlier, is that something I would maybe be good at or should think about doing? Or am I more of like a zone kind of diet where I would, you know, eat throughout the day?
Yeah. So, I mean, from your perspective, I mean, it always depends on you know, what your goals are. So, for example, for you, one of the things with you is that if I look at your gene, which is the UCP2 gene, this is a gene that's all to do with your metabolic efficiency. So you actually have what people classically would term a fast metabolism, but actually what you have is an inefficient metabolism. That is that when you consume food, you don't necessarily store the energy effectively. Mm-hmm. So let's say, for example, you were trying to build muscle, and given that we know that you're metabolically inefficient, but you're trying to build muscle, that means that focusing as many of your calories as possible around exercise actually becomes quite important to you, to make sure you've got enough energy to exercise and then enough energy to recover. So that given your clock gene, which is your gene that's to do with circadian rhythm, actually shows that you should be exercising later in the day. And also, given that you're metabolically inefficient, I would say possibly intermittent fasting for you, as long as you exercise later in the day, could actually be quite an effective tool if you're trying to build muscle and lose body fat. But the other thing that you'd need to account for is the fact that if you look at your PPAR gene, so PPAR is a gene that's all to do with how well you switch from burning carbohydrates to burning fat. And actually, looking at your gene result here, it would suggest that you actually perhaps don't switch effectively from burning carbohydrates to burning fat. So for you, I would say that your diet in terms of your carbohydrates needs to reflect slightly lower carbohydrates than perhaps some people would consume. With your APOC2 gene variation, you need to be consuming slightly lower saturated fats, so more focused on high monounsaturated and high polyunsaturated, potentially using intermittent fasting and focusing your calorie intake before and after your workout. So as long as you're working out later in the day, if intermittent fasting could be something that's quite effective for you. There was one more thing on here. And also as well, taking into account that you're a fast metabolizer of caffeine. So make sure that, you know, you don't sort of consume, you know, too much caffeine early in the day, because there is a risk that you'll actually potentially crash your energy levels because you break down caffeine fast. So, I mean, there's kind of bunches of kind of, you know, interesting, you know, bits of nutrition information that you could use to try and optimize, you know, how you eat. For you as well, I might recommend L-carnitine as a supplement, because you have a gene variation, which means you might have slightly lower IGF binding protein, which is the protein that protects IGF-1 from getting broken down. So because you have slightly lower levels, if you supplement with L-carnitine, it can potentially increase your levels of the binding protein, protect your IGF-1, and therefore increase the likelihood of you building muscle and losing body fat. There's bunches more than we could go into there. Any particular questions on anything I've just said?
Yeah, real quick on the switching from fat to carb burning, does that mean I should have more fat because I'm not? I guess the question I'm asking is am I a better carb burner or a better fat burner? Or I just get stuck in kind of one place and I can't switch from back and forth. Is that what that means?
If your goal is to lose body fat, then one of the things is you don't necessarily switch effectively from burning carbohydrates to burning fat. So if you've got a surplus of carbohydrates, your body is not necessarily going to make a decision to burn fat if there's carbohydrates available, because it isn't necessarily as effective in that switching process. Mm-hmm. So if you're trying to lose body fat, then actually you do want to, you know, slightly reduce your carbohydrate intake. So for example, there are some guys and girls out there that can diet and lose body fat with high carbohydrate intakes, but there are other people that simply cannot lose body fat when the carbohydrate intake is too high, because for that very reason, they don't switch effectively. So for you, you don't necessarily switch effectively. So I would recommend slightly reducing your carbohydrates in order to lose body fat if that was your goal.
Okay. And in terms of sprinter versus long distance things, is there something, a gene on that for there? I think I read it. Am I more of like a sprinter or like a long distance kind of guy?
Yeah, well, I mean, so here's the thing. Your genes don't tell you whether you're more sprint or more endurance. But what your genes can tell you is, are you likely to respond to training that is kind of, you know, geared towards some of those things? So, you know, for example, what I can see from your genes is that you're someone who should be training with quite a lot of volume, but you're also someone that can recover quite quickly and can get plenty of activation of fast twitch muscles. So if you were wanting to improve your power, improve your speed, definitely training to improve, to activate, to stimulate fast twitch muscle, you would get a fairly decent response from. You would also respond quite well to training to improve your VO2 max, because you have a number of gene markers which would indicate that if you were focusing on trying to improve your endurance, then you're someone who would definitely respond well to training to improve your VO2 max. So it isn't necessarily that you're one or the other. It's you know, you have a number of genes that basically, if you made the decision you wanted to be a sprinter, or you made the decision you wanted to be an endurance runner, on the basis that you're training in the right way, you would find that you could easily respond to those methods of training.
Okay, cool. But the if I read that right, when I looked through it, it says something like if you have like a double of both, like one or the other, two of like the same gene or something like that, then you are typically someone who could be like an elite, like world-class athlete in, say, sprinting or marathon running. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, so I think perhaps one of the genes that you're thinking about there is the ACTN3 gene. And this is a gene that produces a protein that essentially signals fast twitch muscle and helps fast twitch muscle repair. So if you have one version or two copies of that particular gene version, of that particular allele version, then it means you produce the protein. Obviously, if you have two, but if both alleles are the C version, then you'll produce much more afractin than if you just have one version. But there isn't necessarily a physiological difference whether you have one or two copies. But if you don't produce the protein, or you have the T version of that gene, then that does have physiological effects, because it means you don't repair, your fast twitch muscle doesn't repair as well, and there are sort of muscle contraction related effects as well.
Okay, and the last thing I wanted to ask on this was the sleep thing. I think it told me that I'm like more inclined to be a night owl. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, more inclined to be a night owl, so therefore more inclined to suffer with disturbed sleep. So for you, definitely, you know, looking at how you prepare yourself for sleep is important. Making sure you don't consume caffeine too late in the day. Your genes would definitely reflect that.
And what's the gene for that?
And that's the CLOCK gene, CLOCK, the CLOCK gene. And that's one of the PER3 genes. So you might remember last year that three Boston-based scientists got the Nobel Prize for their work on the PER3 gene.
All right, cool, man. Dr. Dan, I really appreciate you coming on and sharing your wisdom with our audience, and also sharing your wisdom with me, because I'm going to definitely tailor some things and switch a couple things around after looking at my results. Is there any takeaway, last send-off message you'd like to leave our Elite Man audience, and then also a place that our listeners can check out the fitness genes that you're working on to get, maybe take their own test results and figure out what they should probably do? What's the website for that, and then also a parting message?
Yeah, so if anyone is interested in our particular methods and our DNA testing, they can go to fitnessgenes.com, and there's lots of really interesting information there where you can purchase your DNA analysis kit, or you can potentially select a training system for building muscle, losing fat, getting fit, whatever your goal might be. You know, I think ultimately, you know, what we're trying to do is we're trying to take a lot of confusion out of the market, because you know, I understand, you know, that, you know, many of your listeners will have experienced this themselves, where you just get completely overwhelmed with the amount of choice that's on the market and the amount of things that become available. And it makes it really difficult to create a plan that you can stick to, because you're constantly getting told different things. And I think really what we're trying to do is, you know, we recognize that. And again, you know, we're very focused on empowering people with knowledge of their own biology so they can make better decisions. And so I think that, you know, as a parting message, you know, I understand the problems that people have. I understand why it can be so difficult to achieve your fitness and nutrition related goals. And in the same breath, it can be a lot of fun experimenting. And what we're really trying to do is help guide people into the right experiments so they can achieve great things.
Yeah, I think the work you're doing is fascinating. I think you really are helping a lot of people. And I'm looking forward to see where you take this in the next couple of years, because I think you're only going to get better with it and more accurate and precise with your recommendations. But even right now, like, I'm so excited to go back through and look at my results and see what I can implement. Dr. Dan, thanks again for coming on, man. Really do appreciate it. And I know our guys are going to love this one. Take care, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much.
All right, guys, I hope you enjoyed that episode. But before you go, there's one last thing I need you to do. I need you to subscribe to this podcast right now if you haven't already. By subscribing to the podcast, you get every single episode the minute they're released. Get all of our Elite Man podcast interviews with all of our incredible world-class guests from the lifestyle, health, fitness, business, and social worlds absolutely free. Subscribe now, guys, if you haven't already, and enjoy all future episodes. And yes, if you do love the podcast, leave us an awesome review. We really do appreciate it.